course at Langley headquarters, flew out to Pakistan to meet with Brereton and survey logistical challenges along the border. Anderson had argued unsuccessfully as the Soviet withdrawal approached that the CIA should end its involvement in Afghanistan altogether. More recently, he had spent hours in Washington meetings defending the CIA's liaison with Pakistani intelligence against attacks from Ed McWilliams's supporters at the State Department and from critics in Congress, many of them Massoud's backers. In these Afghan policy wars, Anderson and Brereton were close allies. Together in the field, free from their pointy-headed bureaucratic tormentors, the two of them decided to take a joyride to the site of the new CIA-built radio station, Ali Khel, escorted by several ISI officers. They were on the Afghan border to ensure that a visit by Congressman Charlie Wilson went off without incident. They were in a triumphal mood. They got their hands on an ISI propaganda poster that showed a growling, wounded Soviet bear being stung by a swarm of Stinger missiles. Anderson and Brereton decided that they should tack the poster on the door of the abandoned Soviet garrison at Ali Khel, a symbolic declaration of victory. They rattled across the border without much incident, found their way to the old Ali Khel garrison, and nailed up their poster in a private ceremony. On the way back, they had to cross territory that belonged to Sayaf, a region rife with Arab jihadist volunteers. They hit a roadblock manned by Arab Islamist radicals. From the back of the jeep, Anderson and Brereton heard their Afghan escort erupt into a screaming match with a Saudi rebel wielding an assault rifle. They were yelling in a patois of Arabic and Pashto. Anderson got out, walked around, and saw immediately that the Arab was threatening to execute them. He spoke to one of the jihadists in Arabic. The man's accent suggested he was a volunteer from the Persian Gulf. The Arab pointed his gun directly at the two CIA officers. "They were infidels and had no business in Afghanistan," he said. Instantly alert, Anderson and Brereton surveyed their environment for weapons and maneuvered themselves so that their jeep blocked the Arab's line of fire. From this position, Anderson began to talk to the Arab through his Afghan escort. Eventually, the Saudi decided, reluctantly, that he would not attempt to kill them. The Americans bundled quickly back into the jeep and drove on to Pakistan. It was a rare, direct encounter between CIA officers and the Arab volunteers their jihad had attracted to the border. It signaled the beginning of a fateful turn in the covert war, but few inside the agency grasped the implications. The CIA did accumulate and transmit to Langley more and more facts about the Arab volunteers and their activities. By the summer of 1989, the agency's network of Afghan agents described the Arabs operating in Paktia and farther south as a rising force and a rising problem. Algerian fighters marauded Afghan supply convoys, they said. Wahhabi proselytizers continued to desecrate Afghan graves, provoking violent retaliation. Christian charity workers crossing the frontier reported threats and harassment from Arabs as well as from ardent Afghan Islamists working with Hekmatyar and Sayaf. American and European journalists, too, had dangerous and occasionally fatal encounters with the Wahhabi fighters in the region. The CIA's Islamabad station estimated in a 1989 cable to Langley that there were probably about 4,000 Arab volunteers in Afghanistan, mainly organized under Sayaf's leadership. He was in turn heavily supported by Saudi intelligence and Gulf charities. Within the Islamabad station, there was a growing sense of discomfort about the Arabs, reinforced by Brereton and Anderson's close encounter. But there was no discussion about any change in U.S. policy, and no effort was made at first to talk directly to the Saudis about their funding of Arab volunteer networks. The CIA station knew that large sums of money flowed from Prince Turki's General Intelligence Department to Pakistani intelligence, and that some of this money then passed through to Muslim Brotherhood-inspired jihadists. But the transnational Islamic networks still served a larger and more important cause, Brereton and his CIA colleagues believed. The Arabs might be disagreeable, but their Afghan allies, Hekmatyar especially, commanded some of the rebel movement's most effective fighters, especially in the crucial regions around Kabul and Khost. Throughout 1989, the CIA pumped yet more arms, money, food, and humanitarian supplies into the Paktia border regions where the Arabs were building up their strength. They encouraged Prince Turki to do the same. At the center of this border nexus stood Jalaluddin Haqqani, the long-bearded, fearless Afghan rebel commander with strong Islamist beliefs, who had grown very close to Pakistani and Saudi intelligence during the last years of the anti-Soviet war. Haqqani operated south of Parrot's Beak, near bin Laden's territory. He had been seen by CIA officers in Islamabad and others as perhaps the most impressive Pashtun battlefield commander in the war. He sponsored some of the first Arab fighters who faced Soviet forces in 1987. He had been wounded in battle, in one case holding out in a cave under heavy assault for weeks. He later recovered in Saudi Arabia's best hospitals, and he made many connections among the kingdom's wealthy sheikhs at the annual Hajj pilgrimage, as well as through General Intelligence Department introductions. He was in frequent contact with bin Laden and with ISI's brigadiers. For their part, Pakistani intelligence and the CIA came to rely on Haqqani for testing and experimentation with new weapons systems and tactics. Haqqani was so favored with supplies that he was in a position to broker them and to help equip the Arab volunteers gathering in his region. The CIA officers working from Islamabad regarded him as a proven commander who could put a lot of men under arms at short notice. Haqqani had the CIA's full support. In Haqqani's crude Paktia training camps and inside the Arab jihadist salons in Peshawar, it was a summer of discontent, however. Disputes erupted continually among the Arab volunteers during mid-1989. The Soviets were gone. What would now unite the jihad? Tensions rose between bin Laden and his mentor, Abdullah Azam, the charismatic Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood preacher. The rising civil war between Hekmatyar and Massoud drew in the Arab volunteers and divided them. Because he was based in Peshawar, where most of the Arabs stayed, and because he had wide-ranging contacts in the Muslim Brotherhood networks, Hekmatyar was better positioned than Massoud to attract Arab followers. But Massoud also found support from Arab volunteers, including from Abdullah Azam, whose Algerian son-in-law was Massoud's chief Arab organizer. Abdullah Azam and some of his followers tried to organize an Arab religious group numbering about 200, whose mission was to travel around Afghanistan using Islamic principles to mediate a peace between Hekmatyar and Massoud. But neither of them was in a mood for compromise. Hekmatyar continued his assassination and intimidation campaign against moderate and royalist rivals in Peshawar. Inside Afghanistan, he attacked Massoud's forces. On July 9, 1989, Hekmatyar's men ambushed a party of Massoud's senior commanders in northern Afghanistan, killing 30 officers, including 8 important leaders of Massoud's elite fighting force. Massoud launched a manhunt for the killers. Open battles erupted with Hekmatyar's fighters across the north, producing hundreds of casualties. From Peshawar, Abdullah Azam embarked by land for Takhar that summer to meet with Massoud. Azam flatteringly compared Massoud to Napoleon. He tried to broker a fresh truce. But Hekmatyar continually denounced Massoud in Peshawar before audiences of Arab volunteers, saying, truthfully, that Massoud received aid from French intelligence and, falsely, that he frolicked with French nurses in swimming pools at luxury compounds in the Panjshir. Increasingly, Osama bin Laden sided with Hekmatyar, alienating his mentor Azam. The Arabs in university towns' salons argued about theology, too. Hekmatyar and Massoud both agreed that communist and capitalist systems were both corrupt because they were rooted in Jahiliya, the state of primitive barbarism that prevailed before Islam lit the world with truth. In this sense, the Soviet Union and the United States were equally evil. Hekmatyar and Massoud also accepted that Islam was not only a personal faith, but a body of laws and systems, the proper basis for politics and government. The goal of jihad was to establish an Islamic government in Afghanistan in order to implement these laws and ideals. Hekmatyar and Massoud also both endorsed Qutb's concept of takfir, by which true believers could identify imposter Muslims who had strayed from true Islam, and then proclaim these false Muslims kafir, or outside of the Islamic community. Such impostors should be overthrown no matter how hard they worked to drape themselves in Islamic trappings. Najibullah was one such false ruler, they agreed. In the Peshawar salons that year, however, Hekmatyar's followers began to express extreme views about who was a kafir and who should therefore be the target of jihad now that the Soviets had left Afghanistan. Exiled Egyptian radicals such as al-Zawahiri proclaimed that Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was one such enemy. Benazir Bhutto was declared a kafir by others. Still others denounced the King of Jordan and the secular thugs who ruled Syria and Iraq. Abdullah Azzam, still Peshawar's most influential Arab theologian, resisted this fatwa-by-fax machine approach. He adhered to the more traditional, cautious, evolutionary approach of the old Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Its mainstream leaders were content to build gradually toward the ideal of Islamic government, to create change one convert at a time. Also, Azzam felt that Afghanistan should be the focus of the Arab volunteers' attention, not faraway countries across the Middle East. Why start issuing calls to war against Egypt or Pakistan when the cause that had attracted them all to Peshawar remained very much unfinished? Bin Laden was among those who called for a wider war against impious rulers. "I'm very upset about Osama," Azzam told his son-in-law. The Saudi was a generous, sweet-tempered benefactor of the jihad, but he was being influenced by Arab radicals who cared little for the Afghan cause. "This heaven-sent man like an angel," Azzam said of bin Laden. "I am worried about his future if he stays with these people." But it was Azzam who should have been concerned about the future. At midday on November 24, 1989, as he arrived to lead regular Friday prayers at Peshawar's Saba-i-Leil Mosque, a car bomb detonated near the entrance, killing the Palestinian preacher and two of his sons. The crime was never solved. There were far more suspects with plausible motivations than there were facts. As the founder of Hamas, Azzam was increasingly in the crosshairs of Israel. Afghanistan's still active intelligence service had him high on its enemies list. Hekmatyar was in the midst of a killing spree directed at nearly every rival for power he could reach. Azzam's connections to the Panjshir, including his trip north that summer, may have been enough to activate Hekmatyar's hit squads. Even bin Laden came under some suspicion, although some Arabs who knew him then discounted that possibility. Bin Laden was not yet much of an operator. He was still more comfortable talking on cushions, having himself filmed and photographed, providing interviews to the Arabic-language press, and riding horses in the outback. He had a militant following, but it was not remotely as hardened or violent in 1989 as Hekmatyar's. Bin Laden did seize the opportunity created by Azzam's death, however. He defeated Azzam's son-in-law, Massoud's ally, in a bid to take control of Azzam's jihad recruiting and support network, the Office of Services. Bin Laden and his extremist allies, close to Hekmatyar, folded the office into bin Laden's nascent Al-Qaeda, which he had formally established the year before, evoking images of his one grand battle against the Soviets at Jaji. Bin Laden continued to look beyond Afghanistan. He decided that the time had come to wage jihad against other corrupt rulers. He flew home to Jeddah and resettled his family in Saudi Arabia. He continued to fly back and forth to Pakistan, but he began to spend less time on the Afghan frontier. He had new enemies in mind. 11. A Rogue Elephant. Peter Thompson took over Ed McWilliams's role in U.S. policy toward Afghanistan late in 1989, but at a higher level of the Washington bureaucracy. He was America's new special envoy to the Afghan resistance, with a mandate from Congress and the privileges of an ambassador. Thompson was a bright-eyed, gentle-mannered, silver-haired career diplomat, serving as deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing at the time of his appointment. A multilingual officer with experience in South Asia, although none directly in Afghanistan, Thompson was well-schooled in Washington's interagency policy wars. He was collegial, articulate, and quick with a smile, but also sharp-minded, ambitious, and determined to defend the prerogatives of his new office. Thompson lobbied for and won broad authority from Robert Kimmett, the Undersecretary of State, who had been assigned to watch Afghan policy for Secretary of State James Baker. Kemet signed off on a formal, classified terms of reference for Thompson that spelled out the envoy's powers and his access to policy meetings, a key measure of clout in Washington. Thompson planned to live in Washington and travel frequently to Pakistan until the Mujahideen finally took Kabul. Then, he was told, he would be appointed as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He made his first trip to Islamabad just as McWilliams was being shown the embassy's door. In Peshawar and Quetta, he traveled the same reporting trail as McWilliams had a year earlier, meeting with dozens of independent Afghan commanders and political activists, many of them openly hostile toward Pakistani intelligence and the CIA. He met Yahya and Ahmed Zia Massoud, Ahmed Shah's brothers, and heard angry accounts of Hekmatyar's campaign to massacre Massoud's commanders in the north. He met with Abdul Haq, now openly critical of his former CIA partners. Haq leveled pointed complaints about how Pakistani intelligence favored Hekmatyar and other radical Islamists. From exiled Afghan intellectuals and moderate tribal leaders, including Hamid Karzai, then a young rebel political organizer, he heard impassioned pleadings for an American engagement with King Zahir Shah in Rome, still seen by many Pashtun refugees as a symbol of traditional Afghan unity. Thompson cabled his first impressions back to Washington. The Afghans he met were bound by their hatred of Najibullah and other former communists clinging to power in Kabul, but they were equally wary of Islamist extremists such as Hekmatyar, and were angry about interference in the war by Pakistani intelligence. When he returned to Washington, Thompson's reports reinforced doubts within the U.S. government about the CIA's covert war. The catastrophe at Jalalabad had discredited ISI and its supporters in Langley somewhat, strengthening those at the State Department and in Congress who backed McWilliams' analysis. The CIA was also under pressure from the Mujahideen's champions in Congress because of logistical problems that had crimped the weapons pipeline to Pakistan. In addition, the civil war now raging openly between Hekmatyar and Massoud raised questions about whether the rebels could ever unite to overthrow Najibullah. The Mujahideen had not captured a single provincial capital since the withdrawal of Soviet troops. The fall of the Berlin Wall in early November 1989 changed the Afghan war's geopolitical context, making it plain that whatever danger Najibullah might represent in Kabul, he was not in the vanguard of hegemonic global communism anymore. And McWilliams' arguments about the dangers of Islamic radicalism had resonated in Washington. Within the State Department, tongues wagged about McWilliams' involuntary transfer from the Islamabad embassy, apparently because of his dissenting views. Was Afghan policy so sacrosanct that it had become a loyalty test? Or had the time come to reconsider the all-out drive for a military victory over Najibullah? That autumn in Washington, meeting at the State Department, Thompson led a new interagency Afghan working group through a secret review of U.S. policy. Thomas Twetton, then chief of the Near East Division of the CIA's Directorate of Operations, attended for Langley. Richard Haass, from the National Security Council, participated in the sessions, as did delegates from the Pentagon and several sections of the State Department. An all-source intelligence analysis, classified secret, had been produced as a backdrop to the policy debate. The document assessed all the internal government reporting about U.S. policy toward Afghanistan from the summer of 1988 to the summer of 1989. It laid out the splits among American analysts about whether Pakistani intelligence, with its close ties to the Muslim Brotherhood-linked Islamists, supported or conflicted with U.S. interests. Influenced by the McWilliams critique, members of the Afghan working group looked for a new policy direction. They were not prepared to give up completely on the CIA-led military track. The great majority of Afghans still sought Najibullah's overthrow, by force if necessary, and U.S. policy still supported Afghan self-determination. Military force would also keep pressure on Gorbachev's reforming government in Moscow, challenging Soviet hardliners in the military and the KGB, who remained a threat to both Gorbachev and the United States, in the working group's view. But after days of debate, the members agree that the time had come to introduce diplomatic negotiations into the mix. Ultimately, Thompson finalized a secret new two-track policy, the first major change in the American approach to the Afghan war since the withdrawal of Soviet troops. The new policy still sought Najibullah's ouster, but it also promoted a moderate, broad-based successor government. On the first track of the new approach, the State Department would open political negotiations aimed at sidelining the extremists, meaning not only Najibullah, but anti-American Islamists such as Hekmatyar and Sayaf as well. American diplomats would begin talks at the United Nations with the Soviet Union, with Benazir Bhutto's government, and with exiled King Zahir Shah about the possibility of a political settlement for Afghanistan. The State Department could now honestly argue that U.S. policy was no longer the captive of Hekmatyar or Pakistani intelligence. At the same time, the CIA would continue to press the covert war to increase rebel military pressure against Najibullah. The use of force might coerce Najibullah to leave office as part of a political settlement, or it might topple him directly. The CIA would continue its collaboration with Pakistani intelligence and would also bypass ISI channels by providing cash and weapons directly to Afghan commanders fighting in the field. Thompson hoped to overtake the moribund, discredited Afghan interim government with a new commander's shura to be organized with American help, made up of rebel military leaders such as Massoud, Abdul Haq, and Ismail Khan. By strengthening these field commanders, the Afghan working group believed, the United States could circumvent the Islamist theologians in Peshawar and their allies in ISI. The new policy pointed the United States away from the Islamist agendas of Pakistani and Saudi intelligence, at least on paper. Thompson flew to Islamabad early in 1990 to announce the new approach to Pakistan's government. Oakley arranged a meeting at the Pakistan Foreign Ministry. Milton Bearden had rotated back to Langley the previous summer. His successor as Islamabad station chief, known to his colleagues as Harry, attended for the CIA. Harry, a case officer from the old school, had a pleasant but unexpressive face, and he was very difficult to read. He was seen by his State Department colleagues as closed off, unusually secretive, and protective of CIA turf. Pakistani intelligence also sent a brigadier and a colonel to take notes. Thompson had invited ISI in the hope that they would accept and implement his initiative. He described the secret new American policy in a formal presentation that lasted more than an hour. The Pakistanis expressed enthusiasm, especially the diplomats from Pakistan's foreign ministry, led by Yaqub Khan, who had long advocated a round-table political settlement involving King Zahir Shah. Even the Pakistani intelligence officers said they were in favor. Thompson planned to fly on to Riyadh to make the same presentation in private to Prince Turki at the headquarters of Saudi intelligence, and from there he would go to Rome to open discussions with the aging, exiled Afghan king. But it took only a few hours to learn that the chorus of support expressed at the foreign ministry had been misleading. After the presentation, Thompson and Oakley were talking in the ambassador's suite on the Islamabad embassy's third floor when the CIA station chief walked in. "Peter can't go to Rome," Harry announced. "It's going to upset the offensive we have planned with ISI." The chief explained that with another Afghan fighting season approaching, the CIA's Islamabad station had been working that winter with Pakistani intelligence on a new military plan to bring down Najibullah. Rebel commanders around Afghanistan planned to launch simultaneous attacks on key Afghan cities and supply lines. The new offensive was poised and ready, and supplies were on the move. If word leaked out now that the United States was opening talks with King Zahir Shah, it would anger many of the Islamist Mujahideen leaders in Peshawar who saw the king as a threat. The CIA chief also argued that Islamist Mujahideen would not fight if they believed the king was coming back. Hekmatyar and other Islamist leaders would almost certainly block the carefully planned offensive. Thompson was livid. This was exactly the point. The new political talks were supposed to isolate the Islamist leaders in Peshawar. But they discovered that Harry had already contacted the CIA's Near East Division in Langley, and that Thomas Twetton, the division chief, had already complained to Kimmett at State, arguing that the opening to Zahir Shah should be delayed. Bureaucratically, Thompson had been outflanked. "Why are you so pro-Zahir Shah?" Twetton asked Thompson later. Thompson flew to Riyadh and met with Prince Turki, to explain the new American policy, or at least the new State Department policy. But Rome was out for now. It was the beginning of another phase of intense struggle between state and the CIA, in many ways a continuation of the fight begun by McWilliams. What did it matter? At stake was the character of post-war, post-communist Afghanistan. As Thompson contemplated Afghanistan's future, he sought a political model in the only peaceful, modernizing period in Afghan history, the decades between 1919 and 1973, when Zahir Shah's weak but benign royal family governed from Kabul, and a decentralized politics prevailed in the countryside, infused with Islamic faith and dominated by tribal or clan hierarchies. Thompson believed the king's rule had produced a slow movement toward modernization and democratic politics. It had delivered a national constitution in 1963 and parliamentary elections in 1965 and 1969. By appealing to Zahir Shah as a symbolic ruler, the State Department hoped to create space in Afghanistan for federal, traditional politics. After so many years of war, it obviously would not be possible to return to the old royalist order, but wartime commanders such as Massoud and Abdul Haq, whose families had roots in traditional political communities, might construct a relatively peaceful transition. The alternative, the international Islamism of the Muslim Brotherhood enforced by Pakistani military power, promised only continuing war and instability, Thompson and his allies at state believed. CIA analysts, on the other hand, tended to view Afghanistan pessimistically. They believed that peace was beyond reach anytime soon. Pakistani influence in Afghanistan looked inevitable to some CIA operatives. Islamabad was relatively strong, Kabul weak. There was no reason for the United States to oppose an expansion of Pakistani power into Afghanistan, they felt, notwithstanding the anti-American rhetoric of ISI's jihadist clients. Thompson might possess an interagency policy document that committed the CIA to a new approach to the Afghan jihad, but he had yet to persuade CIA officers to embrace the policy. Some of them found Thompson irritating. He had a habit, perhaps unconscious, of coughing up light laughter in the midst of serious conversation, including during solemn, tense interactions with key Afghan commanders or Pakistani generals. Some of the Afghans seemed to recoil at this, CIA officers observed. Thompson sought to strengthen his position inside the embassy by building a partnership with Oakley, but the ambassador was an elusive ally, embracing the envoy and his views at some points, but denouncing him disrespectfully in private at other times. More broadly, the CIA operated in Pakistan largely in secret and with great autonomy. The Islamabad station was connected to Langley with a separate communication system to which diplomats did not have access. In the station and at headquarters, most CIA officers regarded Thompson's new policy as a naive enterprise that was unlikely to succeed. They also saw it as an unwelcome distraction from the main business of finishing the covert war. As for post-war Afghan politics, the CIA's Twetton felt that the Afghans were going to have to sort it out themselves. It might get really messy. The United States should not get involved in picking political winners in Afghanistan or in negotiating a new government for the country. There was nobody capable of putting Afghanistan back together again, Twetton believed, including Massoud. Still, the CIA had a mission backed by a presidential finding— to support Afghan self-determination, however messy, through covert action and close collaboration with Pakistani and Saudi intelligence. The CIA's Near East Division officers said they had no special sympathy for Hekmatyar or Sayaf, but they remained deeply committed to a military solution in Afghanistan. They were going to finish the job. A Pakistani military team traveled secretly to Washington to lay out an action plan for an early 1990 offensive. The plan would include support for a new conventional rebel army built around Hekmatyar's Lashkar-e-Asar, or Army of Sacrifice. Pursuing its own agenda, Pakistani intelligence had built up this militia force, equipping it with artillery and transport to compete with Massoud's irregular army in the north. Hekmatyar's army was becoming the most potent military wing of the ISI-backed Muslim Brotherhood networks based in Pakistan, a force that could operate in Afghanistan but also, increasingly, in Kashmir. The CIA stationed in Islamabad helped that winter to coordinate broad attacks against Afghanistan's major cities and roads. Some of the planning involved ISI, but the CIA also reached out through its secret unilateral network to build up key Afghan commanders, including Massoud. If dispersed rebel units, even some at war with one another, such as those loyal to Hekmatyar and Massoud, could be persuaded to hit Najibullah's supply lines and cities at the same time, they might provide the last push needed to take Kabul. The CIA and Pakistani intelligence remained focused on the fall of Kabul, not on who would take power once Najibullah was gone. Harry, Gary Schroen, and their case officers met repeatedly during that winter of 1989-1990 with officers in ISI's Afghan bureau to plan the new offensive. Harry met face-to-face with Hekmatyar. The CIA organized supplies so that Hekmatyar's forces could rocket the Bagram airport north of Kabul as the offensive began. Massoud figured centrally in the CIA's plans that winter. Schroen traveled to Peshawar in January to talk to Massoud on a secure radio maintained by his brother Yahya. Schroen asked Massoud to cut off the Salang Highway as it entered Kabul from the north. If Massoud's forces closed the highway, while other ISI-backed rebel groups smashed into Khost and Kabul from the east, Najibullah might not be able to resist for long, the CIA's officers believed. Massoud negotiated for a $500,000 cash payment, and Schroen delivered the money to one of Massoud's brothers on January 31, 1990. But Massoud's forces never moved, as far as the CIA could tell. Furious at "that little bastard," as he called him in frustration, Harry cut Massoud's monthly stipend from $200,000 to $50,000. The Islamabad station sent a message to the Panjshir emphasizing the CIA's anger and dismay. All across Afghanistan, the CIA's offensive stalled. The Mujahideen seemed uncoordinated, unmotivated, and distracted by internal warfare. They did not capture any major cities. Najibullah remained in power in Kabul, unmolested. As spring approached, the CIA station began to pick up reports from its unilateral Afghan agents that Pakistani intelligence was now secretly moving forward with its own plan to install Hekmatyar in Kabul as Afghanistan's new ruler. The CIA's informants reported that a wealthy fundamentalist Saudi sheikh, Osama bin Laden, was providing millions of dollars to support ISI's new plan for Hekmatyar. The Islamabad station transmitted these reports about bin Laden to Langley. On March 7, 1990, in downtown Kabul, the conspiracy erupted into plain view. Afghan Air Force officers loyal to Najibullah's hardline communist defense minister, Shahnawaz Tanai, swooped over the presidential palace in government jets, releasing bombs onto the rooftop and into the courtyard, hoping, but failing, to kill President Najibullah at his desk. Defecting armored forces loyal to Tanai drove south from the city, trying to open a cordon for Hekmatyar's army of sacrifice, which hurried toward Kabul from the Pakistani border. With help from Pakistani intelligence, Tanai and Hekmatyar had been holding secret talks about a coup attempt for months. The talks united a radical communist with a radical Islamist anti-communist. The pair shared Gilzai Pashtun tribal heritage and a record of ruthless bloodletting. Tanai led a faction of Afghanistan's Communist Party known as the Khalkis, who were rivals of Najibullah's faction. According to the CIA's reporting at the time, the money needed to buy off Afghan army units and win the support of rebel commanders came at least in part from bin Laden. These reports, while fragmentary, were consistent with the agency's portrait of bin Laden at the time as a copious funder of local Islamist causes, a donor rather than an operator, a sheikh with loose ties to Saudi officialdom who was flattered and cultivated in Peshawar by the recipients of his largesse, especially the radicals gathered around Hekmatyar and Sayaf. During the same period that the Tanai coup was being planned, around December 1989, Pakistani intelligence reached out to bin Laden for money to bribe legislators to throw Benazir Bhutto out of office, according to reports that later reached Bhutto. According to Bhutto, ISI officers telephoned bin Laden in Saudi Arabia and asked him to fly to Pakistan to help organize a no-confidence vote in Parliament against Bhutto's government, the first step in a Pakistan army plan to remove her forcibly from office. That winter, then, bin Laden worked with Pakistani intelligence against both Najibullah and Bhutto, the perceived twin enemies of Islam they saw holding power in Kabul and Islamabad. If Bhutto fell in Islamabad, and Hekmatyar seized power with Tanai's help in Kabul, the Islamists would have pulled off a double coup. Did bin Laden work on the Tanai coup attempt on his own, or as a semi-official liaison for Saudi intelligence? The evidence remains thin and inconclusive. Bin Laden was still in good graces with the Saudi government at the time of the Tanai coup attempt. His first explicit break with Prince Turki and the royal family lay months in the future. While the CIA's Afghan informants named bin Laden as a funder of the Hekmatyar Tanai coup, other accounts named Saudi intelligence as a source of funds. Were these separate funding tracks or the same? None of the reports then or later were firm or definitive. It was the beginning of a pattern for American intelligence analysts. Whenever bin Laden interacted with his own Saudi government, he seemed to do so inside a shroud. Hekmatyar announced that he and Tanai had formed a new revolutionary council, but within hours of the first bombing attacks in downtown Kabul, it became obvious to wavering Afghan commanders that the coup would fail. Government troops loyal to Najibullah routed Tanai's defectors in Kabul. Tanai himself fled to Pakistan, where he and his cabal were sheltered by Pakistani intelligence. Hekmatyar's army of sacrifice never penetrated the capital's outskirts. It remains unclear exactly when the CIA's Islamabad station learned of the Hekmatyar Tanai coup attempt and whether its officers offered any comment, supportive or discouraging, to Pakistani intelligence. Many CIA operatives felt that Pakistani intelligence officers never were honest with us on Hekmatyar, as Thomas Twetton, then number two in the Directorate of Operations, recalled it. At a minimum, ISI's officers knew when they planned their coup that the CIA was creating a helpful context by organizing attacks on Najibullah's supply lines. But the CIA also kept secret from Pakistani intelligence the extent and details of its unilateral contacts with Afghan commanders such as Massoud. The agency did not inform ISI, for instance, about the $500,000 payment it made to Massoud on January 31, just 5 weeks before the coup attempt. The coup's timing is also swathed in mystery. Tanai may have moved hurriedly, ahead of schedule, because of a military treason trial underway that winter in Kabul that threatened to expose his plotting. In the aftermath, Massoud stood his ground in the north. The CIA might be angry at him for failing to hit the Salang Highway that winter, but what was he supposed to make of Hekmatyar's plot to take Kabul preemptively, a conspiracy so transparently sponsored by Pakistani intelligence, the CIA's intimate partner in the war? Massoud had ample cause to wonder whether the CIA, in making its $500,000 payment that winter, had been trying to use his forces in the north to help install Hekmatyar in Kabul. Massoud told Arab mediators that he still hoped to avoid an all-out war with Hekmatyar. He did not want a direct confrontation with ISI, either. Massoud made plain his ambition to assume a major role in any future government in Kabul. He expected autonomy for his councils in the north. He did not aspire to rule the Pashtun areas of Afghanistan directly, however. He knew that was impractical for any Tajik leader. How much Massoud would be willing to negotiate with Pashtun leaders remained open to question. Peter Thompson hoped his national commander's shura would provide a vehicle for such compromise beyond the control of Pakistani intelligence. One thing was certain. Massoud would not stand idly by while Hekmatyar seized power in the capital. Massoud husbanded his supplies that spring, built up his alliances across the north, and waited. The long anti-communist jihad's last act still lay ahead. Hekmatyar's eagerness to conspire with a hard-line communist general and the willingness of Pakistani intelligence to support the plot appalled many Afghans and bolstered support for Peter Thompson's new policy approach in Washington. The coup attempt made plain that Afghanistan's Cold War divides were dissolving rapidly. Extremists from seemingly opposite poles in the post-Soviet-Afghan war had linked up. It was all the more crucial, Thompson and his allies argued, for the United States to build up moderate centrists in the Afghan rebel movement and to search for stable post-war politics. It was by now conventional wisdom within the State Department that Saudi intelligence had become the Afghan war's most important hidden hand, and that no new approach could be constructed without Prince Turki Al-Faisal's personal support. Peter Thompson and his team traveled frequently to Riyadh. Prince Turki remained an elusive, ambiguous figure. In the decade since his first meetings with Pakistan's General Akhtar and his Afghan clients in 1980, the prince had evolved into one of Saudi Arabia's most important leaders. A high-level interlocutor between American officials and the Saudi royal family, and a frequent and mysterious traveler to Middle Eastern capitals. He maintained palatial residences in Jeddah and Riyadh. He summered at luxurious resorts in Europe. Now 45, and no longer the boyish foreign policy expert he had been at the start of his career, Turki had become an elegant professional, an attentive consumer of satellite television news, and a reader of serious policy journals. He had built personal relationships with senior officers in every intelligence service in Europe and the Arab world. In addition to Pakistan, he poured subsidies into the intelligence services of moderate Saudi allies such as Morocco and Jordan, buying access to information and people. He seemed most at home on the luxurious circuit of foreign policy and international security conferences held at Davos, Switzerland, or the Aspen Institute in Colorado, where diplomats and generals debated the challenges of the post-Cold War world while smoking Cuban cigars. Within the Saudi royal family, Turki's influence was constrained by his relative youth. In a political system based on family and seniority, he languished in the second tier, tied by blood and political outlook to the family's most liberal and modernizing branch, but not old or well-placed enough to be its leader. Still, as CIA and other American officials identified Turki as perhaps the most reliable individual in the Saudi cabinet, and as his reputation for serious work grew, Turki established an authority within the Saudi government far greater than his years would otherwise permit. On Afghanistan, he was without question the man to see. Whisked to the General Intelligence Department's boxy Riyadh headquarters in a long-stretch limousine, Thompson and his team, usually including the CIA's Riyadh station chief, sat for long hours with Turki in the spring of 1990 to talk about the new American approach to the covert war. These were languid sessions on overstuffed Louis XIV furniture and air-conditioned offices laden with tea and sweets. Turki seemed to revel in such conversation. The meetings would begin at 10 or 11 p.m. and drift toward dawn. The prince was unfailingly polite and persistently curious about the details, even the minutiae, of the Afghan war. He tracked individual commanders, intellectual figures, and the most complex nuances of tribal politics. He had questions, too, about American policy and domestic politics, and, like many other Georgetown University alumni influenced by Jesuit rigor, he seemed to enjoy abstract, conceptual policy issues. Thompson and others at the State Department tried to persuade Prince Turki that Saudi interests as well as American interests now lay in moving away from the Islamists backed by his own operatives and by Pakistani intelligence. Thompson wanted Saudi funding to help build up his alternative shura of independent Afghan rebel commanders outside of ISI control, but with a strong role in the new movement for Massoud. In Washington, Thompson arranged for a meeting between one of Massoud's representatives and the influential Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, in the hope that Bandar would cable back his support for the commander's shura to Prince Turki and others. Turki handled the appeal that spring the way Saudi intelligence usually dealt with sticky conflicts. He opened his checkbook, and he played both sides. Turki handed over millions of dollars to support Thompson's new commander's initiative. At the same time, Turki increased his support to Pakistani intelligence, Thompson's nemesis, outstripping the CIA's contributions for the first time. For the period from October 1989 through October 1990, Congress cut its secret allocation for the CIA's covert Afghan program by about 60% to $280 million. Saudi intelligence, meanwhile, provided $435 million from the kingdom's official treasury and another $100 million from the private resources of various Saudi and Kuwaiti princes. Saudi and Kuwaiti funding continued to increase during the first 7 months of 1990, bettering the CIA's contribution. Saudi intelligence organized what it called the King Fahd Plan for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, a $250 million civil project of repair and construction. This tsunami of Gulf money ensured that even if the CIA's operatives cooperated fully with the new U.S. policy designed to isolate extremists such as Hekmatyar, the agency's efforts would be dwarfed by the unregulated money flowing from Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. What was Prince Turki's motivation in this double game? The Americans who interacted with him, who mainly admired him, could only speculate. They accepted that Turki, like Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to Washington, or Saud al-Faisal, the foreign minister, belonged to the pro-Western modernizing wing of the Saudi royal family. Compared to some other senior princes, Turki embraced American and European culture and sought to emulate the West's models of economic development. Clearly, he imagined a Saudi Arabia in the future where the kingdom's economy interacted closely with the United States and Europe, and where economic prosperity gradually produced a more open, tolerant, international culture in Saudi Arabia, albeit one still dominated by Islamic values. Yet Turkey's funding of radical Islamists in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere empowered leaders and movements violently opposed to the very Western systems Turkey professed to admire. Why? Like the CIA, the Saudi government was slow to recognize the scope and violent ambitions of the international Islamist threat. Also, Turkey saw Saudi Arabia in continual competition with its powerful Shiite Islamic neighbor, Iran. He needed credible, Sunni, pro-Saudi Islamist clients to compete with Iran's clients, especially in countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, which had sizable Shiite populations. The Saudis inevitably saw Massoud and his northern coalition through the prism of language. Massoud's followers predominantly spoke Farsi, or Persian, the language of Iran. And while Massoud and his Panjshiri group were Sunnis, there were Shias in their northern territory. Within Saudi Arabia itself, Prince Turki's modernizing wing of the royal family was attacked continually by the kingdom's conservative ulama, who privately and sometimes publicly accused the royals of selling out to the Christian West, betraying Saudi Arabia's role as steward of the holiest places in the Islamic world. The internal struggle between the austere Ikhwan militia and the royal House of Saud, less than a century old, was far from over. Prince Turki and other liberal princes found it easier to appease their domestic Islamist rivals by allowing them to proselytize and make mischief abroad than to confront and resolve these tensions at home. American motivations during this period were easier to describe. Indifference was the largest factor. President Bush paid hardly any attention to Afghanistan. CIA officers who met the president reported that he seemed barely aware that the war there was continuing. His National Security Council had few high-level meetings on the subject. The Soviet Union was dissolving, and Germany was reuniting. These were the issues of the day. With Soviet troops gone, Afghanistan had suddenly become a third-tier foreign policy issue, pushed out to the edges of the Washington bureaucracy. The covert action policy, while formally endorsed by the president, by 1990 moved to a great extent on automatic pilot. Still, American negotiators made clear in public that they were trying to chart a new policy direction, however far they might operate from the center of White House power. Undersecretary of State Robert Kimmitt announced that the United States would not object if Najibullah participated in elections organized to settle the Afghan war. After the initial delay caused by the CIA, Thompson opened the first direct talks between the United States and exiled King Zahir Shah. "The impression is being created that the Americans are actually concerned with the danger of the spread of Islamic fundamentalism," Gorbachev confided to Najibullah in private that August. "They think, and they frankly say this, that the establishment today of fundamentalism in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran would mean that tomorrow this phenomenon would encompass the entire Islamic world. And there are already symptoms of this, if you take Algeria, for example. But the Americans will remain Americans, and it would be naive if one permitted the thought that we see only this side of their policy and do not notice the other aspects. In Islamabad, the CIA-ISI partnership was under pressure. There was continual turnover at the top of both intelligence agencies. Benazir Bhutto fired Hamid Ghul as ISI chief because she learned that Ghul was conspiring to overthrow her government. She tried to bring in a Bhutto family loyalist, a retired general, to run ISI. But the new man could never control the Afghan bureau and resigned. The next ISI chief, Asad Durrani, quickly discovered the outlines of the CIA Islamabad station's unilateral network of paid Afghan commanders, including the agency's extensive independent contacts with Massoud. This discovery reinforced the rising suspicions of Pakistani intelligence officers that the Americans, in bed with Bhutto, were now playing their own double game. Peter Thompson deepened these Pakistani doubts by flying in and out of Islamabad, convening meeting after meeting to push both the CIA and Pakistani intelligence to support his new grassroots national commander's shura. The assembly convened for the first time in Paktia, attracting about 300, mostly Pashtun, commanders. To aid the effort, to bolster Massoud, and to improve Massoud's supply lines, the U.S. Agency for International Development built all-weather roads from Pakistan to northern Afghanistan. At first, the CIA objected to the emphasis on Massoud. The station had just cut Massoud's stipend because of his failure to attack the Salang Highway. Because of the agency's secrecy rules, CIA officers could not tell most of their state counterparts about what had happened, which exacerbated tensions between the two groups. Still, under continual pressure, the agency agreed to give Massoud another chance. Pakistani intelligence continued to build up Hekmatyar's army of sacrifice, integrating Tanai and other former Afghan army officers into its command. In October 1990, the CIA station's unilateral Afghan network reported a new alarm. A massive convoy of 700 Pakistani trucks carrying 40,000 long-range rockets had crossed the border from Peshawar, headed to Kabul's outskirts. There, Hekmatyar planned to batter the capital into final submission with a massive artillery attack, the largest of the war by far, a barrage that would surely claim many hundreds of civilian lives. On October 6, Thompson met in Peshawar with 10 leading independent commanders, including Abdul Haq and Massoud's representatives. Hekmatyar's planned reign of death on Kabul would be worse than Jalalabad, the commander Amin Wardak warned. As a confidential cable to Washington describing Thompson's meeting put it, the commanders were keenly aware that an unsuccessful military attack with heavy civilian casualties would rebound against the Mujahideen. They would be seen in the eyes of the world as complicit in mass killings. Also, if Kabul fell without a replacement government, there would be political chaos, Abdul Haq warned. Massoud and other commanders who could not accept Hekmatyar would wage war against him. Wardak estimated further destruction, perhaps 200,000-300,000 casualties, the October 10 cable reported. As it happened, this was a grimly accurate forecast of Kabul's future. Only after Oakley warned of the gravest consequences for American-Pakistani relations if Pakistani intelligence did not abandon the plan, did Durrani, the ISI chief, agree to call off the attack and turn the trucks back. Tanai, too, as the planned mass rocket attack came to be known in the Islamabad embassy, had been aborted in the nick of time, but it signaled the Pakistani army's deepening break with American priorities. Oakley, now more firmly opposed to Pakistani intelligence than he had been during McWilliams's tour, denounced ISI as a rogue elephant in a meeting with Pakistan's president. Had the CIA known about this Hekmatyar rocket assault plan all along? Had Harry endorsed or acquiesced in it, despite the prospects of thousands of civilian deaths in Kabul? Thompson and others at State believed he had. They saw this episode as an example of the independent CIA war being commanded in secret from the Islamabad station, while State's diplomats followed their own policies. Thompson and Harry met at the station chief's house in Islamabad, and over tuna sandwiches and soup, the CIA chief recounted the history of the October rocket attack plan as he knew it. He described a meeting he had attended with ISI and Hekmatyar, at which Hekmatyar, boasting of his ability to capture Kabul for the Mujahideen, had exclaimed, "I can do it!" The station chief said he had insisted that Hekmatyar work with other Afghan commanders. Thompson concluded that the Islamabad station had likely endorsed the operation, and perhaps even authorized weapons and other supplies. Thompson regarded the decision as not only a horribly bad one, but symptomatic of a larger danger. It reflected all the ills of the CIA's own self-compartmentalization and inability to understand the Afghan political context, Thompson wrote at the time. Days after the excitement over Hekmatyar's aborted attack, Thompson drove to the northern Pakistani town of Chitral to prepare a second National Commander's Shura. Masood attended, as did prominent commanders from around Afghanistan. The organizers, who included Abdul Haq, banned Hekmatyar's commanders. Sayaf ordered his commanders to boycott. But hundreds of other Afghan rebel leaders gathered for days of political and military discussions. It was the largest gathering of wartime Afghan field commanders in years. ISI's Durrani insisted on attending. He stayed in a tent nearby, but was excluded from the meetings. Still, the ISI chief managed to get a message through to Masood, and he invited him to Islamabad for a meeting. Masood's representatives met with Prince Turki in Riyadh for the first time. Turki agreed to facilitate a new rapprochement with ISI. Masood, who had been stung by the cutback of his CIA subsidy, agreed to travel to Pakistan for the first time in a decade. He was prepared to compete with Hekmatyar for support from Pakistani intelligence as the war's endgame approach. In Islamabad, he met with Durrani and with Harry, the CIA station chief. Durrani, who sought to build trust with Masood and enlist him in a unified rebel push against Najibullah, promised to resume military supplies to Masood. Harry agreed to restore some of Masood's retainer, increasing his stipend from $50,000 to $100,000 per month. The CIA instructed Pakistani intelligence to send more weapons convoys across the now half-built American road to the north. Some of these ISI shipments to Masood, convoys as large as 250 trucks, did get through. On direct orders from the American Embassy in Islamabad, Masood received his first, albeit small, batch of Stinger missiles. But in other cases, heavy convoys dispatched by Pakistani intelligence to Afghanistan's north mysteriously disappeared, never reaching the Panjshir. The Americans suspected that Pakistani intelligence was doing all it could to resist their pressure to aid Masood. A pattern in the CIA-ISI liaison was emerging. Faced with ardent demands from the Americans, ISI officers in the Afghan bureau now nodded their heads agreeably and then followed their own policy to the extent they could, sometimes with CIA collaboration, sometimes unilaterally. The dominant view among Pakistani generals, whether they were Islamists or secularists, was that Hekmatyar offered the best hope for a pro-Pakistan government in Kabul. The strong feeling even among the most liberal Punjabi generals, whose sons cavorted in London and who spent their own afternoons in the army's Rawalpindi golf course, was, "We should settle this business. It's a sore on our backside." The Islamabad CIA station spent much of its time worrying about Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. In 1990, just as the agency's partnership with ISI on the Afghan frontier was fraying, the CIA's sources began to report that Pakistan's generals had pushed their nuclear program to a new and dangerous level. After a visit to Washington, Robert Oakley returned to Islamabad carrying a private message for Pakistan's army. Pakistan was now just one or two metaphorical turns of a screw away from possessing nuclear bombs, and the CIA knew it. Under an American law known as the Pressler Amendment, the CIA's conclusion automatically triggered the end of American military and economic assistance to the government of Pakistan, $564 million in aid that year. After a decade of intensive U.S.-Pakistan cooperation, the United States had decided, in effect, to file for divorce. American fears of nuclear proliferation from Pakistan were well-grounded. Mirza Aslam Beg, the Army Chief of Staff, opened discussions in Tehran with the Iranian Revolutionary Guard about the possibility of Pakistani nuclear cooperation with Iran. Beg discussed a deal in which Pakistan would trade its bomb-making expertise for Iranian oil. Oakley met with the Pakistani